You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Coming up, as state and local officials get ready for a series of elections, we'll find out why some local governments in Wisconsin have failed to keep up with a few common best practices for web security.
First, for the first time ever, the 2020 Newbery Medal, considered the most prestigious U.S. Children's Book Award, was given to a graphic novel. The winner was New Kid, a graphic novel written and illustrated by Jerry Craft.
Graphic novels and comics have soared in popularity, capturing readers beyond the comic nerd stereotype. But some adults still hesitate to let children pick them up, considering them fun, not quality reading like chapter books or novels.
So are they just as good as regular books? What can parents do to overcome those feelings? We've got a librarian on the line now to help us answer those questions.
And we also want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you had this discussion with your child? Does your child like to read graphic novels? Do you like to read graphic novels? And what are some of your favorites? Or if you have any recommendations, let us know. Call 800-642-1234 or comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Nicole Ozanich is the Assistant Director and Youth Services Librarian for the Portage County Public Library. Nicole, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we keep using the phrase graphic novel. Can we use comic and graphic novel interchangeably, more or less?
Yes, I think so. It depends on who you talk to. I look at comics as being sort of the umbrella term, and then graphic novels is a newer concept, and that is basically comics that tell an entire novel-length story.
Now, from your perspective as a librarian, if a kid's reading a graphic novel or comic, whatever we want to call it, are we just happy that they're reading, period?
Yes, we are, especially if they are happy reading them.
So why do we have sometimes the attitude like, no, this isn't the real stuff that we want kids reading? Comics are, you know, not, they're suboptimal reading material.
Yeah, so I'm sure parents have a lot of reasons for that, but I think to some extent people believe that it's cheating because there's pictures to help interpret the story. We also tend to run into the same thing at the library when it comes with audiobooks and nonfiction or information books. People just seem to think that novels or chapter books that are text only are the only way to go.
Now, I know sometimes librarians have even heard that very conversation. No, pick a real book, not a graphic novel, not a comic book. Is that something you've encountered in your own library?
Very much. Yes, definitely from parents, even still from teachers sometimes. And so, you know, we just try to show them all of the options and try to, you know, encourage them to open up reading to all types of formats. You know, reading has changed these days, and now with technology and video games, email, social media, all that sort of stuff, you know, there really is a value of symbols and pictures in reading and using those to interpret the story.
Yeah, I know I learned a lot of my numbers and letters from baseball cards and then from comic books and Charlie Brown and things like that. Yeah, is there something just about, you know, looking at printed symbols on pages and stringing them together that that we're learning, even if it's not a complicated novel?
Oh, for sure. There is research these days that shows that reading books that have a combination of images and text are just as cognitively challenging as text-only reading. And in fact, there's a term, it's called visual literacy. And so that is the reading and interpreting of images.
And there have been some, I guess people call them hybrid series, like Captain Underpants, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Dork Diaries, other things where you've got, you know, a lot of print, but still quite a few images, not, you know, panels like a comic book. How do those fit into the picture for you?
Right. I mean, they're just gateways to kids finding books that they love. That's how we look at it. Any kind of reading is good reading. I mean, motivation is such an encouragement when it comes to learning and reading comprehension. And for some readers, if graphic novels or comics or whatever you want to call them, if that's what they can read and if that gives them a sense of accomplishment for completing an entire book, then that just improves their self-esteem as readers, and hopefully they'll continue that trend into adulthood.
Talking to Nicole Ozanich, Assistant Director and Youth Services Librarian for the Portage County Public Library. We're talking about comics and graphic novels, and she says, hey, parents, teachers, they're good reading for kids. Don't look down at them. So, Nicole, say a parent comes in with a younger kid who's in the earliest days of their reading, maybe not even quite reading yet. What kind of things might you point them toward for a comic book kind of format?
Oh, gosh. Well, there are some. There's a series of comic books or graphic novels called Toon Books. And so those are just very simple comics. You know, they still have panels. They have text on each page. There's also the Elephant and Piggy series by Willems. And those are kind of one of those comic hybrids, I would say. We also have sections of books that are meant for those beginning readers. So really what we like to do at the library is just the best case scenarios to talk to the kids themselves and see what they're interested in and kind of see what they've liked before, what their ability is. If the parents are there as well, we can point the parents in a direction and just give them some tools for finding the best books for their kids. Again, when it comes to their ability, sometimes kids want to read the same books over and over again, and it may be easy reading for them, but they're still learning. And at other times, it's good to challenge the kids with their reading. So really having that variety is key.
Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Fort Atkinson. Mark, hi.
Hello. I'm an industrial arts teacher, and I'm interested in teaching children. I think graphic arts is fine. I also believe that children need to know how to use tables of contents, indexes, charts and diagrams, schematics.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, you know, having that sort of visual, you know, combination of illustrations and words, that might be a good segue to teach us, I don't know, how to build that IKEA furniture in the future or follow other kinds of technical manuals that are also hybrids of text and images. What do you think, Nicole?
Oh, for sure. I mean, visuals sometimes better illustrate a concept than words alone. And that's why you find manuals, they contain images and written instruction. And even, you know, companies use logos to brand themselves. So visuals, I think, are, you know, they are a language across the board that everyone can read. They're not held back as much by language barriers.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Nicole, there's a lot of ground cover now in graphic novels. It's not just the superhero stuff, not that there's anything wrong with that. But can you talk about some of the more, I don't know, serious or issue-oriented graphic novels that have really swept the market in the last couple decades?
Yes, in fact, you're seeing a trend now where kids' comics are expanding comics in the mainstream market. And they are growing by an average of about 30% each year right now. And superhero graphic novels are actually in the decline a little bit. So just like you said, there's a lot of serious issues going on in graphic novels, just like any novels. You mentioned New Kid by Jerry Craft, mm-hmm. which is the first graphic novel to win the highly acclaimed Newbery Award. And that follows a young black boy who is now attending a school with mostly white students. And while they're mostly friendly to him, it really just shows the microaggressions that he is dealing with on a daily basis and just the trouble with trying to fit in, you know, being a student and being a middle schooler. You also have Mariko Tamaki, an author and illustrator. She writes books more for teens, and her newest one is Laura Dean Keeps Breaking Up With Me. And so that shows the struggles of teenage relationships and just finding yourself and knowing when you should cut off a bad relationship.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Nicole, what graphic novels or comics do you see getting a lot of circs at your library coming in and out the door for you?
Well, Dave Pilkey's Dog Man series is not slowing down anytime soon. And Raina Telgemeier is also a huge hit. which is great because there are a lot of female graphic novelists out there right now. And so girls are really getting into comics for the first time because they're actually marketed to them now. And so her Smile series has been huge as well.
Nicole, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Nicole Ozadich is the Assistant Director and Youth Services Librarian for the Portage County Public Library. She joined us today to talk about why reading comics does count as reading for kids. We've got a list, by the way, of recommended graphic novels. We've got that posted at WPR.org/Central Time.
Up next, new reporting from WisConText shows that some Wisconsin county websites are more vulnerable to hacking than they should be. We'll find out what kind of changes are in the works. That's coming up next here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Coming up, the Trump administration is floating the idea of a payroll tax cut and guaranteed sick leave to all hourly workers as the coronavirus continues to spread. We'll get the latest on those proposals and what the government is doing to slow down the virus.
First, Wisconsin has a series of elections in the coming months, and the issue of election meddling continues to loom large for state and local officials in charge of running them.
New reporting from WisConText takes a closer look at some of the web security best practices local governments around the state have failed to keep up with.
Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext. He talked to WPR host Keely Boltina about the story.
We're talking about the Wisconsin Elections Commission and its relationship with local governments. What concerns are happening here?
There are a whole bunch of concerns. First, listeners may be aware of recent action by the commission where they've basically threatened to expose several communities, like half a dozen communities in the state who are still operating operating their systems with insecure devices, whether they're operating on old software that's not being supported any longer or other things. It's not totally clear. They're keeping those communities out of the Wisconsin voter registration base until they update their software or their devices or whatever. To promote security, exactly. And so that's a related issue to what I reported on, but not really the same thing. I was reporting specifically on website security and kind of best practices recommendations.
Sure. So it's all under this umbrella of how do we make sure that our elections are safe and that they have integrity. So you have identified really two main problems when it comes to elections websites, those websites that report the unofficial results the night of the election. And one of them is encryption. What is encryption?
Exactly. Encryption is really basically it's essentially, you're scrambling information that's being communicated between a website server and a website visitor. And it's scrambled while it's being relayed between the server and the website visitor. And then it's unscrambled when it gets to you. And so what that does is it can keep out potentially malicious actors who could snoop on that connection otherwise and see those communications or in some instances even reroute website visitors to dummy websites, which is the primary concern with unofficial election results.
I get it. So if we're talking and we don't want other people to hear, if they're standing here between the two of us speaking, they would be able to have access to it because we are not in a secure environment, that sort of thing.
Exactly. Yep. It's called a man-in-the-middle attack by cybersecurity experts. And there are a whole bunch of different reasons why a hacker might execute a man-in-the-middle attack, a whole bunch of different ends. In the case of unofficial election results that are reported on county websites in Wisconsin, the main concern by cybersecurity experts is that a man-in-the-middle attack could basically quietly, without the knowledge of a website visitor, reroute that visitor to a website that looks virtually exactly the same as an official county website, but maybe reports inaccurate information.
Mm, so all part of misinformation, the concept of like meddling with elections here, without being secure in HTTP and then the S, the secured websites, they're vulnerable to this.
Exactly. Yep. And that's a good point. So yeah, encryption is, it's commonly, or website visitors will be able to tell if the website they're visiting is encrypted with that HTTPS encryption very easily, usually on the upper left-hand corner of a browser, like in the left-hand corner of the website address bar. There will be like an icon of a padlock that ensures you that your connection is encrypted.
And what did you find in your analysis of local government websites that, you know, dealing with HTTPS?
Yeah, so there are 70, and I should say I only looked at counties for this because they're the ones who operate these websites that report unofficial results on election night. And so 13 of Wisconsin's 72 counties currently, or as of yesterday when the report was published, our report on WisConText was published, 13 counties did not use the HTTPS encryption security on their websites.
Okay, so those are potentially more vulnerable than other websites, too.
To these man-in-the-middle attacks, exactly.
We're talking with Will Cushman, who's the associate editor of WisContext, about his reporting into election security when it comes to websites. And the other aspect of this element of security is the concept of .gov websites. We hear a lot of .coms, .nets. We've got WPR.org, but we're dealing with .com. Why do security officials want local governments, those county governments, to move to .gov websites?
That's a really good question. And the basis for my reporting is actually a report from McAfee, a cybersecurity vendor. They published a report in February that highlighted the use of HTTPS, so encryption security, as well as the use of .gov in a domain web address name as two ways that county websites can, or any website that reports official or unofficial voting results, could beef up their security. And the reason for the .gov is interesting. It's basically that the federal government vets the use of .gov domains. So if you want to use a .gov domain, you have to prove that you are a legitimate government entity. All those other domains, .com, even ones that seem more official like .org or maybe even .us, which a lot of counties use, anyone has access to those domains if they can pay for them.
So other people could register that aren't the county and make it look like that. But with a .gov, you are really pretty much guaranteed that this has been through the system and that this is the official website.
Exactly. It's really a cue to website visitors that this is a legitimate entity. It's not necessarily more secure than using another domain. Its value is in the cue to visitors.
And what does your analysis show about the number of Wisconsin counties using .gov websites?
Not very many use them. Only 14 in the state currently use them. So 58 counties do not use .gov domains. I've, in the course of the reporting, spoke with officials at a few counties who are looking to make the move to .gov pretty imminently, but not all of them are.
So some county officials have their eyes on it. You just said some don't. What about election officials in the state? When you talk to them, what are they most concerned about happening if counties don't go in the .gov and the encryption direction?
Yep. Wisconsin Elections Commission, they're really placing a higher priority on moving over to the encryption, so the HTTPS. Encryption security. They said that they also recommend moving over to .gov, but they're not placing such a high priority on that. It can take quite a while to get vetted by the federal government. I've heard anecdotally maybe even like a year or so. So that's not as critical of a concern, especially since it's not a direct security issue. It's more about just making sure that people can really fully trust the results that are reported on election night.
And that's a really important point. We should be completely clear. We're not talking about hacking of actual voting machines or the votes, but we are talking about vulnerabilities in how governments report the votes, right?
Exactly. So this really good thing to be clear about. We're not talking about vulnerabilities to physical elections infrastructure or to the state's voter registration databases or anything like that. This is really all about making sure that citizens in the state are able to fully trust the unofficial election night results. So the results before they're canvassed and certified. And really, ultimately, we want to just the purpose of this is to reduce kind of like the potential for election night chaos. Robert Mueller, the special counsel who investigated for years the 2016 election interference by the Russian government in the U.S. elections, found that a primary objective of that interference was to just sow discord and distrust in our democratic processes. And so this is a way that that objective could be accomplished without actually hacking the voting infrastructure in the state.
And if it is a campaign of misinformation, if counties are somewhat vulnerable because they haven't taken these steps, what is the reason that counties might not move in that direction? Just, I mean, you mentioned time and effort.
Yeah, time. At least moving toward the encryption security, there doesn't seem to be a great reason to not do that. This has been a known best practice for years in the business community. It's standard practice. I actually talked to a cybersecurity expert based here in Wisconsin. He's a professor at the Milwaukee School of Engineering. And he said he was really surprised to see that there were any county websites that aren't using the encryption security yet. And he called it kind of scary, basically because it could point to larger security holes behind the scenes. And actually, the Elections Commission does provide funding, grant funding, and technical support for making the move to that encryption security.
Will, do we know what other states do? We know that Wisconsin has counties report this information. Is there any move toward anything else?
Yeah, Wisconsin is unique in that regard. So Wisconsin's election administration is uniquely diffuse. Municipalities are responsible for administering elections, and then counties are responsible for that election night unofficial reporting. They work closely with the Elections Commission, communicate closely with them on election night, but there is no central authority who is reporting those unofficial results, and that's not the case in other states. So it really is all the more important to have those county websites in Wisconsin be as secure as possible.
All right. Will, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
That was Will Cushman, associate editor of WisContext. He talked to WPR host Keeley Baltina about his analysis of the web security practices of all 72 counties across the state. You can read the full story online at wiscontext.org.
Coming up after the news, we'll get the latest on how the president and Congress are responding to the spread of the novel coronavirus. I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up, Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin joins the show to make the case for her paid sick leave bill in response to the novel coronavirus.
First, we're taking a look at the week in Washington, and the focus in the Capitol this week has been on how to respond to the spread of novel coronavirus and the disease that it causes, COVID-19.
President Trump met with health insurers yesterday to discuss coverage guarantees for coronavirus testing and treatment. He's also floating the idea of providing sick leave to all workers and a payroll tax cut to shore up the economy.
The vice president and some federal health officials maintain the risk to most Americans is low, but that daily life in the coming months may be impacted.
Here in Wisconsin, UW-Madison and UW-Green Bay announced today that they'll join UW-Milwaukee in holding classes online starting later this week and are canceling university-sponsored travel for the time being.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the government's response to the coronavirus so far? If you think it's not going far enough, what would you like to see happen, or too far? What questions do you have about what the government is or isn't doing or working on? And what do you think of some of these ideas, guaranteed sick leave for hourly workers, tax relief for businesses? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
Julie Rovner is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and the host of Kaiser's What the Health podcast. Julie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So as we just talked about, Wisconsin's biggest university is joining some other colleges around the country in switching to online classes for the rest of the semester. What is the White House and its coronavirus task force recommending in terms of school, travel, and, you know, things like that that could impact people's daily lives?
Well, so far they're not recommending things at that level. You know, we're still waiting. This obviously changes hourly, but clearly these universities are heeding, you know, suggestions from public health leaders that the best thing to do at this point, particularly in places where there has been documented community spread or even some places where there hasn't, to increase what they call social distancing. And one of the quick ways to increase social distancing is to do, you know, remote learning. So we saw today in particular a number of large universities really around the country say, you know, many of them are on spring break or about to go on spring break, saying that, you know, after spring break that we're going to conduct everything online. Some of them are maintaining food service and dorms for students who can't easily go home or who have no other way to basically eat if they are not in their dorms. But most of them are saying that all the classes will now be online.
You know, this is just one of the latest things that we're hearing about. And, you know, as the White House continues to address this, we know yesterday the president and the vice president held a meeting with the heads of the country's biggest health insurance companies to talk about coverage for COVID-19 testing and treatment. You know, Mike Pence addressed this group, and this is what he said about that meeting.
All of our major health insurance companies have now joined with Medicare and Medicaid and agreed to waive all co-pays, cover the cost of all treatment for those who contract the coronavirus. They've committed to no surprise billing, and they've committed to encourage telemedicine.
So what more should we know about this agreement with health insurers, and how was it reached?
Well, it was reached just because of moral suasion, but it's important to know that they don't control everything that the vice president was talking about. Surprise bills generally don't come from insurers. They come from providers. They come from the hospitals and the doctors. One of the things that the administration did do was it changed and made an IRS ruling so that employers who provide their own insurance, and that's a majority of people with employer insurance, have what are called self-insured plans. So the insurers don't really control what those plans cover or don't cover. The employers do, and they needed to make sure that if people who have high deductible plans were able to get these particularly tests without going through the deductible, there had to be a change at the IRS level. They did do that, but it's still hard to know exactly, you know, what the guarantee is here. There's certainly an intent that people not have to pay for it, but, you know, if you go to the emergency room, that's not to say a lot of doctors are telling people who think they might have COVID-19 to go to the emergency room. If you walk into the emergency room, there's no promise that the emergency room isn't going to send you a bill. There was a story today about a woman who was sent to the emergency room by her doctor in New York and got a $10,000 bill.
Yeah, I read that story. I mean, this might be a big question, but, you know, healthcare and healthcare insurance in particular is always sort of a big political topic. And you're right that hospitals are the ones that the surprise billing comes from. Do we know of any move at all to regulate the surprise billing on this front on the hospital level?
Well, no, that's what Congress is working on now, and they've been working on it for years, trying to agree on an actual federal legislation that would stop surprise billing, and they haven't been able to. So they can't just wave a wand and say, you're not going to surprise bill. This is really difficult. The healthcare system is regulated at a number of different levels, at the state level, at the federal level for, you know, the states and the feds share Medicaid. The federal government, regulates Medicare. The ERISA, which is a federal law, regulates self-insured employer plans. State insurance regulators regulate fully insured private insurance plans. So it gets really confusing to have everybody with their little piece of it.
So when they brought the insurance companies to the table as part of this discussion, was there any indication what the insurance companies might be getting from the federal government as part of this deal?
No, there was no impression that they were necessarily getting something other than dealing with a public health crisis. And if we, you know, are able to get some kind of breaks on this system, it might in the end save the insurance companies some money. So it's sort of in their interest for this to be controlled. Although, you know, we seem to be sort of past the what they call the containment level and on to the mitigation level, trying to keep the spread as slow as possible so the nation's healthcare system doesn't get completely overwhelmed. overwhelmed.
So on that front, last week, President Trump did sign a bill with $8.3 billion worth of spending on fighting the virus. Can you remind us where that money is going?
Yes, $2.2 billion of it is going to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. About $1 billion of that will be for states and localities for their public health work, surveillance, testing, and contact tracing for people who've been exposed to people who've tested positive. There's another almost $1 billion for the National Institutes of Health to do its research, $61 million for the FDA, which has some authority over the tests and has, as we've heard, been sort of the bottleneck. Another $1 billion for the State Department and the Agency for International Development to try to get a hold on the epidemic, I guess now the pandemic, in other countries to keep it from spreading here. $1 billion in loan subsidies for the Small Business Administration. I think that's most of it.
Yeah, there's a lot in that $8.3 billion. And, you know, this passed with pretty broad bipartisan support in Congress before President Trump even signed the bill. You know, what was the takeaway from, you know, people in Washington as this big bipartisan thing ultimately did pass?
Well, you know, I've covered now a lot of public health crises. I remember, you know, go back to anthrax and H1N1. And it's, you know, when it's a real crisis, Congress sort of sits up and takes notice and does something. But in between these crises, they tend to take money away from public health. And then we have a public health crisis and they say, why isn't the public health system ready to do this? It's because you've been taking their money away for the last however many years it's been since the last public health crisis.
So that sort of ebb and flow between crises and you got the dip and all that. You know, President Trump spoke with reporters yesterday about meeting with Republican lawmakers. Here's a little bit of what he had to say.
We're prepared and we're doing a great job with it, and it will go away. Just stay calm. It will go away. We want to protect our shipping industry, our cruise industry, cruise ships. We want to protect our airline industry. Very important. But everybody has to be vigilant and has to be careful. But be calm. It's really working out.
Has President Trump been on the same page as public health officials in recent days?
Well, not really. You know, public health officials, particularly some of the ones I follow on Twitter, are really very alarmed. There's not been a lot of testing. We've done, the United States in general has not done nearly as much testing as many other countries. So we don't actually know how many people have this. We only know the people who've gotten sick enough and were in the right position to get tested. There are a lot of test results that haven't come back. You know, the president keeps saying anybody who wants a test can get it, but that doesn't really seem to be the case. Now it's not a problem with the tests, but with the reagents that help you actually conduct the tests. There's a shortage of those. So there's an awful lot that we don't know about this and how widely it is spreading. And I think that may sort of account for why we're seeing a lot of, you know, universities and other groups sort of canceling large-scale meetings and any place where, you know, large numbers of people get together.
In that vein, there's that news story that was making the rounds today that a lot of information has been made classified. Some public health officials that are pretty high up can't access some of these meetings. Is there any concern about the flow of information? And do we know what's happening with that story in particular?
Yeah, there is a lot of concern about that. You know, when Vice President Pence was put in charge of the White House task force, he promised full transparency, and now it appears that, you know, their meetings are going to be considered classified. That's not exactly full transparency. So there is a lot of concern about that. And, you know, if you're trying to quell panic, don't quell panic by saying, we know what's happening, but we're not going to tell you.
We are talking with Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, about the response in the nation's capital to the coronavirus.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see the government do in response to this novel coronavirus? What do you think of what they've done so far? Do you have questions about what has been passed, what is still in the works? If you work in a job that doesn't provide paid sick leave, are you worried? Do you think the administration's response so far has been adequate? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll pick up the conversation after a short break here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We continue our conversation with Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and we're talking about the government's response to coronavirus. And I want to take a quick call. We have Savannah in Ironwood, Michigan. Sorry about that. We had a technical glitch. So moving on, you know, over the weekend, the Conservative Political Action Conference, otherwise known as CPAC, several members of Congress had contact with a person infected with coronavirus. Where do we stand on that?
Well, there are, I think, as of a few minutes ago, seven members of Congress who are self-quarantined, not all of them because they had contact with that person, most of the Republicans because they had contact with that person, and now a couple of Democrats who had contact with someone else who is tested positive. Among those who's self-quarantining is Mark Meadows, who's just been tapped as the new White House Chief of Staff. So I guess he's not going to start for 2 weeks if he's staying home.
And, you know, President Trump has had a contact with a couple of these lawmakers who are now in self-quarantine. Is this something that the White House is concerned about at the moment?
They say no. Reporters have been asking, you know, has the president been tested? Because he was, you know, a couple of them traveled on Air Force One with him. He was at CDC last week with Doug Collins, the Republican from Georgia, who's now self-quarantining. And reporters have been told that the White House physician has not suggested that the president get tested.
Now we have Savannah back with us from Ironwood. Hi, Savannah. How are you doing?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to say?
I'm a little concerned about the administration's handling of this response, particularly putting Mike Pence in charge, considering he has a history of mismanagement of viral epidemics. I'm also concerned about the transparency, which you mentioned just a few minutes ago. I think that instead of President Trump being so focused on industry and pretending that the stock market's going to bounce back, I think he should be calling in all the troops and getting ventilators manufactured and getting nurses and doctors trained on utilizing them, because we are going to have a huge influx of patients, elderly patients coming in. I mean, we don't even have any understanding of how widespread this is because we're not doing enough testing.
Thank you for that call, Savannah. And, you know, Savannah hit on a bunch of things. You know, let's address the controversy surrounding Mike Pence really quickly, because people have been critical of how, when he was the governor of Indiana, he handled an HIV outbreak in Indiana.
That's right. There was an HIV outbreak in one county that was basically being spread by the use of unclean hypodermic needles. And the then Governor Pence did not want to authorize a needle exchange program, which eventually they did. But he has been accused of making that epidemic worse and drawing it out because of his reluctance to use what public health authorities were recommending.
Now, I want to go back to our calls. We have Jeff in Superior.
Hi, thank you. I'm very supportive of the Trump administration's actions. I have very, very confidence in Vice President Pence and the team that the president appears with at these press conferences. He's not handling this alone, and I think this really is a issue of personal responsibility. We all need to take responsibility for our health long before this occurs and live a healthy lifestyle and improve our immune system and things like that. So you can't blame Trump for the virus or how it's handled. I think this is really a matter of personal responsibility.
So to Jeff's point that this isn't simply on the government itself, but that there is some personal responsibility there, does that mirror what we're hearing from, like, the CDC about how people should live their day-to-day lives?
Well, obviously people need to do, you know, what is best for them, but also what is best for the community. This is a communicable disease. That's what's so dangerous about it. It's a new disease that no one has any immunity for. So it's, you know, if you're taking care of yourself by limiting contact with other people and washing your hands, that's one thing. If you're taking responsibility for yourself by, you know, going out, continuing to go out in large groups where you may be exposed to people with the disease and take it back home to people who may not have as strong immune systems, that's not such a great thing.
You know, there was a photo making the rounds on Twitter about a lot of people at the Capitol Rotunda today. Is there any sort of move so far as you've heard about maybe limiting some tourism to prevent the spread in the D.C. area?
Well, I've not seen that, although the Mayor Bowser, the mayor of Washington, D.C., has recommended a temporary cancellation of all large groups and large meetings. Mostly that's been taking place anyway. Most of the meetings I've seen that were to take place in the next several weeks have been canceled or at least postponed until the fall.
We're talking to Julie Rovner. She's the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. And I want to look at Congress really quickly because in a lot of ways, they are, a lot of them fall under the high risk demographic. They're people in their 70s who are traveling a lot. Is there a sense on Capitol Hill that we might see more lawmakers getting sick or at least impacted?
Well, there's some Congress members of Congress who are very concerned about that and think that Congress should, you know, shut down and go home. And there are others, including Speaker Pelosi, who's in that high risk age group also, who say, you know, we're in charge. We're the captains. We're the last ones to leave the ship. So there's, you know, a bit of a disagreement, although I will say I just got an email invitation to an in-person press briefing about coronavirus with two Republican senators. And I'm thinking maybe this would be the time to have a phone press conference rather mm-hmm. than gather a lot of people in a room.
I mean, the news still has to get reported, but yeah, finding alternative ways might be a good step. You know, changing tone just a little bit, several Republican lawmakers, including Republican House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, they've referred to this as the China virus. We saw it referred to as China coronavirus, you know, in reference to the fact that the first few cases did appear in Wuhan, China. And President Trump has retweeted content with that language. What are we hearing from the CDC about that? What's the reaction been to this?
Well, it's the WHO, the World Health Organization, that named it, you know, its technical name, the disease is COVID-19. The technical name is, I believe, COV-SARS-2. It has a, you know, they come up with names and they try not to sort of pin it on sort of the place of origin. But obviously politics is politics.
And speaking of politics, we have an election underway, or certainly getting there. And, you know, yesterday, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders both canceled their campaign events. It was kind of the first sign that they were adjusting their plans due to coronavirus. President Trump is still scheduled to hold a rally in Milwaukee next Thursday. Do you think that this is going to make this campaign season look different than what we're used to?
It's hard to know. I mean, it really depends how this goes, how long it goes on, whether sort of shutting things down for a couple of weeks is enough to stop the spread. I think we're just in this sort of uncharted territory right now.
There's a balance between being cautious, though, and still projecting a strong public image. We sort of heard about that with Nancy Pelosi. How do you think politicians are going to be handling balancing that in the months to come?
It's difficult. You know, we keep seeing videos of politicians who say, you know, we're not going to shake hands, and then they shake hands. It's like saying, don't touch your face, and then you touch your face. It's going to be a transition. I would note that both Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden canceled their rallies in Ohio last night because that was the request of the Republican governor. So this is not a completely partisan thing. I mean, there are sort of, you know, members of each party who are trying to be more sort of cautious and later maybe, you know, deemed responsible. And politicians, you know, I noticed the president, who's sort of reputed to be a germaphobe, still out shaking hands with everybody, you know, he comes in contact with. So it's hard to know how this is going to shake out.
You know, on that front, you know, we heard in Detroit, too, that Biden in particular was holding a campaign event, everyone had to use a lot of hand sanitizer moving forward. Do you think that this could affect in some ways people going to the polls if they're worried that they might get sick if they're around a lot of other voters?
That's a big concern, although, you know, a lot of states are trying to make it easier for people to get absentee ballots, or in many states are now going to completely vote by mail. So that is one way to sort of mitigate the problem of having to stand in line, which people don't want to do, even if they're not worried about getting sick, that they can still vote without having to stand in line with a lot of other people.
In the last about 30 seconds that we have left, Julie, what will you be watching for as, you know, news in Washington, as, you know, the Trump administration is following the coronavirus? What is sort of on your radar?
At this point, it's just to see, you know, how widely this is spreading, what happens with the testing, with getting the test results back, figuring out, you know, where there are real hot spots, and, you know, whether the public officials are going to follow public health advice about how to shut it down, and what's going to happen with the rest of the world. I mean, the president is right to be concerned about the economy, about, you know, people who work for themselves and don't get paid if they don't go to work, and how to sort of square that. You know, we're a system where everybody doesn't have health insurance coverage, and where health care is expensive, and whether that makes things worse.
Julie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure.
Julie Rovner is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of Kaiser's What the Health podcast. She talked with us about how the White House and Congress are reacting to the spread of the coronavirus.
Coming up in just a few minutes, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin joins the show with more on legislation related to the novel coronavirus.
Coming up in 15 minutes or so, we're going to dig into a little bit of history, and it's history of one of the shortest games in the world, rock, paper, scissors.
To mark the occasion, JC and I will now have an on-air rock, paper, scissors contest, possibly the first in public radio history, though I have done exactly nothing to confirm that claim. Now, before we start, let's get the rules straight. Is it one, two, do we show on three or one, two, three?
I do one, two, three.
Then show.
Then show.
Okay,
yeah.
Ready? All right, here we go.
All right.
Rock, paper, scissors. Here we go.
Okay.
One, two, three.
Oh, okay. I got scissors. So
scissors beats my paper.
Paper.
This doesn't sound very public radio. JC, what was going through your mind as you selected scissors?
You know, I just had a feeling that you were going to throw paper, and I was like, I really want to beat Rob, so I'm just going to risk it, and
you
I'm
going
to throw scissors.
You called it. Okay, here we go. Round two.
Okay, ready?
You're up 1-0.
Yep.
One, two, three.
Oh!
We got two rocks.
Yes.
Okay, that's a tie. That's
okay.
A draw. Okay, next.
One,
two, three.
Oh, I beat you again.
Yep.
I have paper.
Okay. I'm down 2-0. Okay, this one's for all the marbles.
Okay.
I don't know why. Double or nothing.
One,
two, three.
Oh, scissors. Okay, ready?
Okay.
One, two, three. Okay,
scissors beats
now
paper,
you
but
won.
You win 2-1. There you go. You have it, JC, the rock, paper, scissors champion.
I feel so accomplished.
This is Central Time, radio that matters.